Us at 844-967-2789. You text us that same number. Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams and Jim from Eaton. Thank you very much for waiting. I really appreciate it. You say what, sir?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. First point, I'm still waiting for the manifesto from Audrey Haley, the shooter in Memphis. Hopefully it will come out one day and we'll find out why she shot.
For those of in the listening audience who don't know what you're talking about, what are you talking about?
The manifesto that Audrey Haley in Memphis, Tennessee, when she shot the three children and the three adults, there's a manifesto that explains why she was going to do it, and they're still not letting it out to the public.
Okay, so what does that have to do with our conversation now?
That's the first point. This point is to do with our conversation. You're talking about money coming with strings, you know, from the state for the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah. Why should there be strings?
Because every school board in Wisconsin and every other county government, in order to get state and federal money, there are strings attached. And you know, why would we say them, but in Milwaukee, there shouldn't be strings attached? That's my point. Correct? Every school district, you know, the school boards, they believe that they would make the right choice about what to do with their children. But no,
the state does not dictate to Milwaukee public schools what to do with money.
Well, I think maybe, Jim, you were listening to the radio about Governor DeSantis, because he was talking about the notion of the putting strings on, for instance, libraries, what kind of books they can have in the library if they're going to receive state funding. And this is sort of an ongoing thing around the country. And all I can say is that the more I see the notion of imposed strings on localities, the more I see danger, actually, because I think we have people distant from problems being dilettantes, meaning people who dabble trying to solve issues or deal with issues. And to some extent, some of the strings we're now seeing applied are pretty terrifying. For instance, the book strings, you know, libraries are going to have money rescinded from them if they don't impose restraints on certain kinds of books. I was kind of proud to see a New York State person say, you know, we're going to do just the opposite. We're going to withhold money from libraries that put constraints on the books that are available. We're treading an awful lot of fine lines here in America relating to essentially basic democracy. So I guess I would question your notion that strings are natural and that strings ought to be applied. It all depends, really, doesn't it? And revenue sharing has not typically involved much in the way of strings, but it can be done. And sure, but the kind of ones that are being talked about from Milwaukee are unusual ones. The notion that policemen must be in each school, for instance, is a choice that you would think a locality would make and wouldn't be imposed by the state.
COVID money, it all had strings attached. You know, you do things for COVID in order to get this money. You know, it always comes that way from the federal and the state. Well, you know, we don't get the money unless we do.
Well, there are strings. There are strings. There are strings, and then there are strings. I guess I don't think we here are arguing about the notion that there can't or shouldn't ever be conditions attached to money that's shared. But I think the question comes down to details and facts, and the devil's in the details.
So let's say this, Jim. I don't think anybody in the state is trying to tell Eden how many police officers they need to have. And if they're not telling Eden, then why should they be allowed to tell the city of Milwaukee?
Because there is a crime problem in Milwaukee, and that destroys a city.
Well,
that's why they
listen. There are crime problems everywhere. Because let me say this. Maybe I don't know. I've never been to Eden, but I think there's a police force in Eden, right?
We don't have hijacking of cars.
No, wait a minute. No, what I'm saying to you is there's a police force everywhere. Which means there's crime everywhere, even in Eden.
Well, Eden probably has methamphetamine, and there's other issues underlying. If there's fentanyl all around the state, there's opioid addiction, there's all kinds of problems. And problems tend to be different locality to locality, which is my point, that how can the state dictate better than localities what it is that localities ought to be doing? And, you know, it is true, I suppose, that there are conditions in which states can declare things to be so in such bad shape that they actually take over governance of it. But taking over governance means that you're actually going to roll up your sleeves, put people in the place, and start learning everything you need to know in order to solve the problems. That isn't what's happening in the state legislature with respect to, for instance, the police requirements in Milwaukee.
Jim?
Yeah.
So yes. So that's the point we're making, sir, is it's easy for people from different parts of the state to think that Milwaukee should be forced into things, you know, and you're going to be, you know, the big brother to Milwaukee. You know, all Milwaukee is asking is a fair opportunity that it can govern itself, and a fair opportunity that we get back the resources that we send back to the state.
You know, actually, Jim, this is—I think you're an interesting person to have on the line, because I do think that we do have in this urban-rural kind of contest that's going on not only in Wisconsin but around the country. We have the polarity of politics: red rural and blue urban. But we also have, I think, a distance of understanding between the two areas. And for instance, in Milwaukee, yes, we do have crime problems in Milwaukee that aren't the same as the crime problems that exist elsewhere. And our crime problems are—I'm sure you would agree—are sociologically premised, right? We have different sociological conditions in Milwaukee than you do in Eden, don't you think? Don't you think that's true?
Yes.
And we have
probably
we have a less homogeneous population. We have a denser population. We have a higher percentage of our population living in poverty, probably. I don't know. I mean, does Eden have a high poverty rate? Or what county is Eden in? I'm sorry to say that I don't know.
Fond du Lac.
Fond du Lac County.
Fond du Lac.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the different areas have different sociological conditions that need resolution as well. And I guess I would simply ask you whether if you think that there ought to be conditions associated with the imposition of police force pressure in Milwaukee, do you also think that there ought to be a redeployment of money towards solving the sociological problems in Milwaukee? Because, you know, we do have sociological conditions that require dealing with, and they're different than the ones in Fond du Lac. And so I guess I'm only suggesting that when the state only looks at the police side, but they aren't willing to look at the other costs and issues that relate to it, the school district and the problems we have in the school district that relate, again, to these same sociological conditions.
You know, Sandy, which, if not met, are going to require even additional resources to be spent endlessly on law enforcement.
So Jim, just from Eden, do you have a good understanding of what the sociological conditions and situations are in Milwaukee, or do you think that there's more to be learned on your behalf?
Well, sociological problems are still dealt with if you break the law, you deserve to
yes.
be held accountable.
Yes,
that's
the point.
But the
point I'm making is that under different sociological conditions, there's a greater likelihood that people will break the law. This was true in Charles Dickens' period, in Oliver Twist in London during the Industrial Revolution, when you had poverty-ridden ghettos in London. They were also crime-ridden. I mean, with poverty comes a higher rate of crime. I think this has been known for centuries, actually. And don't you think that the sociological conditions that exist in Milwaukee require some treatment at the government level or some attention at the government level, as well as the outcome of that, which seems to be higher crime?
It depends on what you're going to do. But if you're never going to arrest anybody,
Wait, Jim, just a minute. Have you visited any of the prisons in the state of Wisconsin? Do you know what the racial mix is of the prison base in Wisconsin?
Probably 70% are people of color.
Yes.
And we only make up 5% of the population.
So I mean, the people being arrested in the state of Wisconsin are many more. People in our prison system come from the city of Milwaukee than come from any other part of the state. So people are being arrested. The rate of crime might make it harder to get arrested, and the kind of crime you're talking about, which is this carjacking situation, and most of them aren't jacked. Most of them are stolen without the people in the car. By teenage kids in Milwaukee is a serious problem, and it's one that Earl is working hard on with his vote group, and others in the city are as well, trying to come to grips with it. But when you have that kind of population committing crimes, it's much harder to deal with, wouldn't you say? I mean, I'm confident that in Eden, if a 13-year-old kid in Eden took a car, the locality would deal with him differently than might occur here.
Yeah, the sheriff would have to actually drive after them and stop them. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
That's what's happening. Hey, Jim, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for taking the time out, man. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So, at 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, the United States ambassador to China and President Joe Biden himself has said they're ready to talk and have dialogue again, open dialogue with China. I'm glad to hear that. Because this thing has really gotten out of control. Is it safe to say we've kind of created a situation where, you know, China's moving its military around? We're talking about what we're going to do. Why did we ever get to this point?
Yeah, it's kind of like we've played a big role in stirring the pot, and now we're going to ask the pot to stop being stirred. Yes, and I think you and I have talked about this with alarm, the notion that the extent to which on a bipartisan basis in Congress, We see Congress people trying to outdo one another in their xenophobia, you know, their xenophobia being anti-Chinese. And we have a foreign policy that talks about, with great hostility, preparing for a war with China. We've been fanning the waves over, fanning the flames over Taiwan. And so, yes, I mean, praise the Lord. If the United States is prepared now to bring back to a much saner position our dealings with China, I think it can have a big impact. China is accomplishing a great deal around the world on its own, you know, in terms of its dealings with Iran. It's currently clearly
Ukraine.
It's having clearly having an impact in Ukraine and has the potential to have real impact in Ukraine.
And peace, and looking for peace.
Yes, China is the biggest trade partner with South Korea, and the South Korean president was being criticized for his trip to America as the result of the notion that it might cause some hostility between South Korea and China. At least this was criticism in South Korea. I just think maybe the United States establishment, the government establishment, has awakened to realize that taking China on in a hostile manner is really counterproductive and will be very expensive in every way for the United States.
And we've ratcheted this up and put this information out where the American citizens have become anti-China.
Right. I mean, I think the important thing for the government standpoint, and maybe this is the beginning of it, is for the American government, the people who sort of run our foreign affairs, to start moderating.
And others.
Yes, to start moderating the discussion about China and de-escalating that discussion down to something that is much, much more fact-based and much less based on machismo, a kind of basic anti-communist kind of stuff that had retreated to. You know, we were going back to our view of China in 1965, because in 1971 we reached out to China, and ever since then we softened our position with respect to them. And most people who are savvy about foreign affairs would say China and America have far more in common than they have running against one another, other than the fact that China is moving in the direction of being America's equal in the economic stage.
So our view is we need better channels between the two governments and deeper channels, and we are ready to talk. This is the ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. Burns said at an event at the Stimson Center, which he attended virtually, "We've never been shy of talking, and we hope the Chinese will meet us halfway on this," he said. Burns reiterated Blinken's trip to China would be rescheduled when conditions are appropriate for his visit, adding that the U.S. is ready for a more broad-based engagement at the cabinet level. That is, you know, I was listening to some conservative the other day, watching them, and they were talking about how China's got a bigger maritime force than we have, and they're catching up with us and all of these. And I'm like, man, who cares, right? I mean, as long as we can have channels, and if they're catching up to us, what does that say about us that we, as small as we are, that we've got all of this armament, and nobody should have a right to catch up with us? I mean,
I don't know how rapidly they're catching up. You can pick different things to measure and say they're catching up. You can look at amphibious landing craft and say, yeah, they've caught up. You can look at aircraft carriers and say, well,
no, you know, they have not.
We have six and they have one, or whatever the count is. It's all just done selectively. But the fact is that regardless of how accurate you think their reporting is, they're only spending a fraction of what we spend every year on their defense budget. And so how fast can you catch up at that rate? But catching up belies...
Just the verbiage catching up.
Yeah, the verbiage suggests that America has to be dominant in the world, and we can't sustain that. Our great grandchildren will not be able to afford the tax they will have to pay in order to have the United States be dominant over the developed world that will exist 40 years from now.
Yeah, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Again, it looks for all the world like the American government is looking to change the trajectory of the conversation towards China, which Sandy, you and I have been talking about for a long time, and that it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
No, it's
right.
It's actually crucial, because the trajectory of that conversation was horrifying and was going to create a potential for problems in the near term, the long term, cost problems. I mean, we should not back into cactuses so quickly.
Let's go to Tom from LA. Hey, Tom, what's going on?
Hey, Earl. I just want to ask the question: has there been any Republican policies that you guys can think of that's actually helped reduce crime? Because to me, every policy that the Republicans have, well, that's just Sandy, this question. Sandy, what policy have the Republicans put out that has actually helped working class people? Because we all know that poverty brings about crime. Republicans seem to like crime because that way they have something to run on for campaigns. So if the crime was taken care of because there was more of an equality in terms of wealth and people didn't have to, you know, rob cars and do this and do that, or whatever type of destructive behavior that they're doing, if they had an actual, you know, going back to our $64,000 equation, what the hell do these Republicans want? They keep cutting, only brings about more crime. So then they can run on crime and say it's the Democrats in the Democratic state or cities, because most cities are metropolitan. That's where some of the crime is happening. There's more people.
Well, you know,
so, can you answer any of that for me?
Oh, you know, Tom, we were going to get into those kinds of things with the debt ceiling conversation, but I'll let Sandy go ahead and respond.
Well, no, I mean, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. I would actually accuse both parties of not accomplishing anything to speak of, but I would say the Republican Party has not even tried. I think the Democrats have made an effort in that direction, but I think the paralysis of Congress has made it impossible to solve it. Certainly, the tax changes that were created under the Trump administration did nothing. That was about the only accomplishment they could point at that point. And you're right that when the government decides to deal with crime, they usually take it head on. You know, Bill Clinton was part of that, and as well as the war on drugs that started a long time ago. And you know, all of that direct assault on crime has done nothing more than fill our prisons with people who are convicted of crimes, and it hasn't solved the problem of mitigating the situations that cause crimes. And so No, I would say that certainly the Republican Party has made no effort in that regard, and I'm afraid that our legislatures generally have just failed us in that regard.
So Tom, thank you for the call, because I want to get back, Sandy, to and we'll get to that later on in the show, but I wanted to get back to, again, what's happening with our conversation with the United States and with China. This is, again, Ambassador Burns has said, Burns also emphasized that in recent weeks, in the last month or so, there's been a consistent communication between myself and senior officials in the foreign ministry, my colleagues in the U.S. mission, and their counterparts in foreign ministry here. It's been a good sign that we've been able to pass messages, trade views, talk about difficult issues sometimes at great length here in Beijing. But you do need a broader relationship than that, he said. Now listen to this. The ambassador also said the U.S. would like to see China push Russia to end its war in Ukraine, and said the conversation between Xi and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was a good first step. It'd be helpful if China pushed Russia to cease bombing of Ukrainian schools and Ukrainian hospitals and Ukrainian apartment buildings. We've seen a tremendous loss of life just in the last month or two, but we believe that China can have a major impact with Ukraine. What?
Well, you know, I think that what realization is coming out that, you know, with a broad worldwide economic integration, the globalization, and with China's pivotal role in that. I mean, to hear that China is the biggest trading partner with so many different countries in the world and is developing trade relationships with them and has this capacity quite rapidly to extend credit to and to provide infrastructure support to countries. I mean, there's little doubt that if and when the war in Ukraine ends, and if it ends in such a manner that Ukraine is being rebuilt by the rest of the world, I can almost guarantee you that China will play a very pivotal role in that reconstruction of Ukraine, just as it has played a pivotal role throughout Africa and in South America. China has demonstrated a very wise approach to foreign affairs, and they have put themselves in a position, based on their strong economic relationship, to forge a position of a world leader. And I think that's one of the things they're intent on doing. So I would expect that if the Ukraine war ends in the next year, I would not be at all surprised to find out that China is in the very middle of that negotiation in terms of being able to accomplish it. And if Ukraine gets rebuilt, I'm confident that China will play a role there. You can see Macron going to China to forge better relations between France and China in terms of trade.
In spite of what we felt.
Yeah. So I think that I think the United States is waking up to the notion that we have to stop exciting the American public into a China phobia, xenophobia, that creates an impossibility to forge a good working relationship with China, because a working relationship with China is going to be an important process in the future.
So let me ask you, Sandy. So when we talk about globalization, and from the perspective of America, it's always as if America is right there at the apex of globalization. It's not going to remain that way anymore, right?
Well, America played a big role in the globalization because it was our businesses that spread out to these other places to access their low-cost labor and to do, but in the process of that, every economist could have told them that you're going to build middle classes in these other places. You're going to build economies in these other places. These other economies are going to grow and are going to begin to catch up to the level of development of the Western world, Europe and America. And as they do that, the power of America will be diluted, okay? And we should have had our eyes open to that in the beginning, and we should not have worried about it, because— –
It was inevitable?
Well, it's, number one, it's inevitable, and it has nothing to do with the prosperity of America. America has every capacity to be prosperous without being dominant. I point at Norway or some other countries like that who are highly prosperous, who no one talks about dominating, all right? You know, it would be, and if the United States is wise about its foreign policy, we can at least put off to the distant future the time when the American dollar is not the world currency, because the dollar being the world currency is very important to America. And the more we use that dollar as a weapon, okay, and the more we get involved in sort of demonizing other economies by partitioning them off from the rest of the world with the dollar, the more we threaten that dollar as the world currency.
Let's go to Bill, our good friend Bill from Oconomowoc. Good morning to you, Bill. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Good morning, sir. Sandy, I got a question for you. If you ever write a book, let me know. Or if you've written books, I want to read them. I really like your thoughts on China. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, China's primary goal, and their number one, is capitalism. They have succeeded in capitalism. They're good at capitalism. I don't know if people realize they invested in the U.S. with debt and everything else. They're a big part of our, you know, if you want to call it global capitalism, but I think that's what they want. The last thing they want is war. Would you agree, Sandy? I'll hang up.
Well, yeah, I think that their conduct has always suggested that war is not their intent, that economic success is their intent. And we should, you know, I was thinking about this actually as I drove out here, the notion that we would have a mercantile war. When you study history and you look at the wars in the 1700s, they always related to tariffs and they were related to merchant issues and economic issues. And the notion that we would go to war over that is abhorrent. But so much of our drum beating about China was really premised on the economic success of China. And you point out that China believes in capitalism. Well, they believe in a version of capitalism, okay? Just like the European version of capitalism that includes social safety nets, I think is a very successful version of capitalism that is more successful for the Tom, Dick, and Mary participants in their capitalism than what we have in the United States. China has a different version. And I think that what we all ought to be doing is keeping our eyes open and figuring out what's the best version, you know, a lessons learned kind of thing. And the United States version of capitalism, in my mind, is not the best version in the world right now. And we ought to be alert to that. And we ought to figure out the things we could do in America that we could learn from other countries. But we ought not to paint China in the category of the old Marxist version of communism that we used to think about, because they're far different than that. They have a very hybrid version of government, which probably is a version of government that is better suited for governing 1.3 billion people than the version we have.
So, Sandy, let me ask you, because this thing has gotten red hot about Taiwan. And more elected officials, one of our state officials, a friend of mine, was in Taiwan last week. So we've got elected officials from all over the country heading to Taiwan, and I don't know, as if we were building up towards something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to know that needed to be brought down. Man, the wick was already lit.
Well, the problem was that the notion that China would invade Taiwan was premised primarily on the notion that we would arm Taiwan and that Taiwan would declare its independence from China. But more and more people are standing up. Jack Ma, I think is his name, the head of the biggest
right.
business in Taiwan, has said, no, we don't want to be independent from China. We want to work this out. And so I think that by the U.S. backing off from having such a strident position about Taiwan, creates an environment in which the danger of China invading Taiwan becomes very minimal. China doesn't need to invade Taiwan. They would only need to invade Taiwan if Taiwan was going to declare its independence from China. But right now, I'm not sure why China would want to rock the boat. I'm sure that China wants to enter in negotiations with Taiwan to figure out how they can become more enmeshed with one another than they currently are.
But that's not our business.
Not really our business. So, you know, I'm pleased to hear that this kind of rhetoric, because I think it's all designed to soften the animosity that's brewing right now in our domestic conversation about China.
All right, we've got to go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, smaller banks are scrambling as share prices plunge. Investors are not convinced that regional banks, including PacWest and Western Alliance, can remain viable. Some are actively betting on their demise. What, Sandy, this is not going away.
Well, yeah, you know, my fear, I guess my hope had been that confidence would be restored quickly by the acts of the FDIC guaranteeing the larger deposits and sort of laying to rest the notion that people's deposits were at risk. But I think the inability of the FDIC to promise that they would do it for all banks leaves open this little chink in the armor with respect to the ability of people to be fearful for their deposits. And these regional banks are banks that that need to rely to some extent on large deposits. Let me just give you an example. The restriction on the level of deposit that's guaranteed by the FDIC is $250,000. But if you're a business that has 400 employees, it's a good-sized business, not a big business, your payroll account for 400 employees is going to be millions of dollars. And so you need to have your payroll account in one bank. And so you'll have deposits in a bank that are maybe $5 million because you need to. And that means that you are $4,750,000 over the guarantee.
Right.
Okay. And so there are lots of banks around the country that have a substantial percentage of their deposits that are above that guarantee level. Silicon Valley was up at like 75% of their deposits. Signature Bank was also significantly higher. Republic Bank was very much higher. PacWest, probably to some extent the same case. But the problem is that when confidence wanes, it doesn't matter what the Fed says, because everyone understands the Fed can't announce there's a problem, because if they announce there's a problem, it's a huge problem. And, you know, every bank in the country is threatened. And so we end up with a situation in which various banks are being exposed. And once that bank gets exposed as potentially being a problem, it becomes a real problem. And PacWest is one of those banks that has been under kind of a microscope by the people who look at banks to see whether they're troubled. And, you know, I think that what we need is the Fed to step in, or the FDIC needs to step in quickly and say, yeah, we are going to guarantee larger deposits, particularly for businesses. Individuals don't have the same need to have deposits in excess of $250,000, but businesses certainly do. And then hopefully this problem could wane, but this problem is coming before the problems that are going to occur in the real estate market. We've got all kinds of real estate developments that will be threatened by higher interest rates and lower occupancy rates in the commercial level. So we've got problems on the horizon that are going to pressure banks even more. Banks have to increase their level of loss reserves, it's called. When a bank starts understanding that loans are going to go bad at a higher rate than they normally did, they have to reserve more money to face that fact. So we've got more pressure on banks coming up in the near future. Everyone knows that. Now we have this additional problem of deposit pressure, deposits leaving banks. So the banking sector is going to be under more pressure. The problem with banks is we've all given them more credit for wisdom than they should have been given, because when you take out a mortgage, you have the opportunity to have a fixed rate mortgage or a variable rate mortgage. The variable rate mortgage will be cheaper in the near term, but you understand that rate could go way up in the future. And so there's a risk. And so most people with variable rate mortgages take a year or two, but then they fix the rate because they don't want to be exposed to that risk of the rate going up. Well, banks did just the opposite. They invested in long-term treasury bonds that were yielding, let's say, 1.5% interest, because otherwise they were earning nothing on other things. So they decided to take a 10-year bond at 1.5% interest, but they knew that if interest rates went up to 4%, the value of that bond would fall dramatically. Okay. They also made lots of loans, long-term loans, at low interest rates, because that was the prevailing interest rate. They just didn't line up the risk of interest rate change with the maturities of the things they had. So they did the opposite of fixing the mortgage rate on their variable rate mortgage, and the interest rate went the wrong direction on them. And smart banks wouldn't have done that, okay? Smart banks don't chase the profit that they can get for the next year on that 1.25%, and they protect themselves by staying what we would call liquid, by keeping that money in something that's much more like cash, lower interest, but when interest rates go up, they don't lose money.
You know, Sandy, all these things in the housing market starting to show some signs, the thing with the banks, and then continue strong job growth. How is all those things, all these different things pulling against one another?
Yeah.
How's the job growth continue to be so strong?
Well, you know, there's signs that it's weakening, and at some point it will weaken. But like I said before, I think that the pandemic scared people out of layoffs. So the number of layoffs has been very minimal. They get headlines when they happen, but they aren't happening across the board. We still have huge shortages in the crafts. You talk to plumbers and carpenters and those, and they're still looking for people to do work. So we have dislocations in the job market in the United States, and to me that's a good thing, actually, for Tom, Dick, and Mary. I do fear that the confluence of the bank problems, the restrictions on lending, the oncoming potential problems in the real estate markets and real estate loans, the slowdown in real estate development that's clearly happening right now and will continue to happen, all of these things portend the possibility that we could have a slowdown in our economy that rises to the level of recession.
All right, listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.